Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Ramesh Srinivasan. Ramesh is a professor of information studies and design media arts at the University of California at Los Angeles, the director of the UC Digital Cultures Lab, and the author of the book Beyond the Valley, which focuses on how innovators from around the world are overcoming inequality and creating the technologies of tomorrow. Ramesh has written several other books, including After the Internet and Whose Global Village. In this interview, Ramesh discusses why and how we should look past Silicon Valley for innovation. He argues that innovation is happening all around the world, and he shares his experiences in countries like Kenya and Mexico, citing how these countries are doing more with less and being resourceful, rather than feeling as if economic or infrastructural constraints are restricting their ability to act. He claims that individuals in these countries are innovating with constraints. Further, he cautions against creating a world in which the inequalities that we currently see are amplified by technological innovations that are only defined within the valley. Instead, he advocates for an internet that lifts all of us up because it creates a win-win scenario. We also discuss Ramesh's goal to have a digital bill of rights, his lab's attempt to bring a variety of scholars and researchers into contact with one another and share their learnings with the wider public through workshops, engaging with journalists, and writing books, companies Ramesh has seen emerge in the countries he's worked in, and a variety of other topics. Ramesh Srinivasan, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Hey, Peter. I'm very happy to join you this morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I thought we'd begin with your role as an academic. You are a professor of information studies and design and media arts at the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. You're also the director of the UC Digital Cultures Lab. And I wonder if you could just take a brief moment and describe your work in both cases.
Yeah, so I've been a faculty member at UCLA since 2005. I am a hybrid of an engineer and a social scientist. I think, you know, as we'll probably talk about in a little bit, Peter, being trained as an engineer with both undergraduate and graduate degrees and being interested in the future of technology and its impact on our country and our world, you quickly realize that you also have to be a social scientist to understand those issues, because it's not simply limited to engineering better, you know, computer systems or faster computer systems. So my work at UCLA has really explored technology's meaning and impact across the world, across the global South, in relation to our economic and political realities. And I realized, you know, as I was publishing journal papers and applying for National Science Foundation grants and stuff like that, that it was very, very important to me to get a lot of what I was learning out to the public so people could understand what's happening with technology and make decisions around their own relationships to technology and really understand its effect on all of our lives in quite profound ways. When I say technology, I mean the internet and mobile and digital technology. But I also realized some years ago, Peter, that it's not just about me. You know, we are all in communities. You know, journalists like yourselves are friends and colleagues to me. And I wanted to apply that same model toward thinking about collaborations between different academics and graduate students. You know, being part of UCLA means we're also part of the University of California, which is a pretty wonderful thing. And there are just great people across the University of California system, from economists to lawyers to people in business schools to computer scientists to social scientists, who are all thinking about technology in quite multidisciplinary and complementary ways. So that's what the lab is. It's an attempt to bring a bunch of scholars and researchers into contact with one another and also share what we're learning with the wider public through workshops, through engaging with journalists and writing books and so on.
Speaking of writing books, you've written several of them now, including After the Internet, Whose Global Village, and most recently, Beyond the Valley, How Innovators from Around the World are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow.
I wonder, as the third title is the most recent, I thought we'd linger a little bit longer on that one. And I'd love to get your diagnosis of the inequality and sort of the rationale ultimately for the book itself. What do you diagnose as the issues today that need to be overcome, or where change is necessary?
Yeah. I mean, I think the internet is fantastic. All of us are connected to the internet in various ways. The internet is, the vocabulary by which our lives are increasingly being expressed and defined. The book is intended. So Beyond the Valley is my attempt to basically explain and illustrate that in many ways, the future for the internet and the future for technology does not just lie in Silicon Valley or in Seattle or even in Shanghai or Beijing in China. It's actually defined by the majority of its users, of these technology companies, service and platform users who are in places like Latin America, South America, South Asia, and obviously across the continent of Africa, where the internet is most rapidly expanding, the fastest growing population in the world, the youngest population in the world. So I guess what I was trying to do is give a very holistic image of where we're at with technology. And, some of the challenges, which of course are quite well known now in the mainstream media, that of the false positives, the gaps that emerge between, well-intentioned, in many cases, engineers working for private companies who are building technologies for the simple, more or less the simple outcome of getting more users and keeping more users on their platforms and services. But there's a gap between their worlds and the worlds of these people who might be 6,000 miles away, 8,000 miles away, just might be from completely different demographic realities, racially, culturally, environmentally, even with the infrastructures they take for granted. We take for a number of ideas for granted here in the United States around what connectivity means and what it supports and what it doesn't support. But those premises can really be challenged when we start looking at examples across the world. So that's why the book is critical in some ways of some of the disconnections that the connectors, the technologists have with the wider world. So there is that criticism, but it's also actually a very optimistic book. It's asking us, as per the title, to think beyond the valley, to learn from examples beyond the valley, to learn that innovations in technology are not simply limited or restricted to a design cubicle at Apple or an engineering workforce in Shanghai, that there are all sorts of innovations involving technology that we can learn from different communities across the world, who in a larger sense represent the majority of the internet's users and the places where the internet is most rapidly expanding right now.
Very interesting. And in seeking out those stories, you went to places like Detroit here in the U.S. and Red Hook, Brooklyn, as well as places like Oaxaca in Mexico, Uganda, Kenya. I'm curious, actually, how you determined where to go. You had, as you mentioned at the outset, your desire was to find diverse stories that were perhaps, even in some cases, run counter to the inherited wisdom as to where innovation's taking place. So much of it, of course, in your state, especially north of where you are, you're closer to Silicon Beach than to Silicon Valley, but up north in the Bay Area. But I'm curious, how did you find the stories that you wanted to tell in such a diverse array of places?
Yeah, such a good question, Peter. And I'm actually from Silicon Valley itself, actually. So a lot of this is also my own story. And I went to Stanford in the late 90s. And, so a lot of these transformations in Silicon Valley are ones that are quite closely connected to my own life and, the worlds of my friends and even my parents and so on. So this is something I've seen firsthand. So I quickly realized, while I was in graduate school, I was at MIT in graduate school, I started to realize that, we were building technologies for global wide-scale use, ideally for use by, millions, if not billions of people. And we didn't really know or understand the actual realities, nor could we, nor should we, nor should we be expected to. But that doesn't mean it's not an issue. We didn't really understand those realities of people living across the world, as I already pointed out. But we did want to, I mean, our whole goal was to build technologies to support them and in ways to kind of get them digitally engaged. And at that time, we used to use the term, I bet you remember this, digital divide. So
indeed,
it's kind of like a term we've moved past a little bit right now, because we're now realizing it's not just about access to my technology. It's about what kind of technology designed by whom impacts what aspects of people's lives. So I've been sort of exploring those themes in different parts of the world. And, you know, for example, in the Oaxaca case, I became very interested in this idea of, you know, open source and free software technology, but not just sort of that as some sort of hacker response to private technology, but more like, what are people doing? How are they innovating with open source technologies in parts of the world that you never could imagine they were doing that? So, you know, I had, while I was a PhD student, worked a lot with Native American communities, building systems and networks with those communities. And so through the grapevine, just starting to do that kind of work, kind of culture technology or global technology oriented stuff, I was introduced to folks in the Oaxaca region, which is, you know, you and I have met not far away from there, Peter, at President Fox's ranch a couple times. And that's actually how I met President Fox on a plane, President Vicente Fox. Mm-hmm. And he and others have been big supporters of my work, because what I'm trying to learn from, and in a place like Oaxaca, is how one of the most diverse places in the world, which it really is in a, on a biodiversity level, but also culturally and linguistically, how that can be a site of technological innovation. So I was just blown away to find out that communities that were not provided with cell phone access by Carlos Slim or by Movistar, you know, the two, Telcel and Movistar, the two big providers, these are indigenous communities, said, hey, we really want connectivity. We really want cell phones for a range of reasons, getting crop prices, communicating with our relatives, you know, organizing things a little more smoothly, even speaking our own languages, which are usually not written down, like Zapotec, for example. But we want to do it on our own terms. So instead of just kind of complaining or waiting for the time when, you know, either the government or corporations would provide them service, they said, hey, we can just build it ourselves. That's a kind of innovation, right? Doing more with less, being resourceful. That's innovating with constraints rather than feeling like constraints that you have economically or infrastructurally make you unable to act, you know, take you away from having agency. So that example just kind of was incredible to me. I was very interested, as I mentioned, you know, to you earlier, in places like Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, because these are places where not only has the internet expanded, but there are all sorts of interesting examples of grassroots entrepreneurial innovation, civil society and nonprofit innovation. There are examples, as I describe in the book, of AI labs, artificial intelligence labs that are actually founded from African universities. You know, Google itself has set up an AI lab in Accra, in Ghana, in West Africa. And the reason why I kind of got over that way is I initially had heard of a project that was actually quite famous some years ago, Peter. It was called Ushahidi. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they are, even President Obama had visited the Ushahidi offices. And basically what Ushahidi was, it came out of Nairobi, Kenya, which Kenya is one of the most technologically innovative places I find in the world. And it was a project where there was a lot of election corruption and sort of not just corruption, but even some violence that occurred. And this was like a model about 10 years ago we all used to talk about, and we do still a little bit with some of the political campaigns, crowdsourcing. People said, hey, there's all this corruption occurring. Why don't we allow all the voters, all the citizens to map where problems are occurring and where, you know, good stuff is happening? And so this was an open source technology where people could real-time map events and describe what was occurring and deploy, you know, their own observations and create a real-time open source map that everybody, all the voters, could monitor real-time. So they would know what's going on thanks to the power of the crowd. Completely democratic project, open source technology. Obama himself had praised that technology some years ago, I think when he first visited Kenya. And this was really interesting. It's a model of African technological innovation. And there are many others. So I think when I started learning about that, and then, you know, it's kind of a small world in a way, Peter, where you kind of have friends who have friends, you know, I realized very quickly I was introduced and on panels with multiple members from Ushahidi. That's an old project, but that actually gave me an opportunity to be introduced to a lot of people doing all sorts of new forms of technological innovation, both hardware and software, in Kenya, Uganda, and so on. So, for example, one of the examples I give in the book, In Beyond the Valley, my new book, is of this really interesting business that is also kind of a social entrepreneurship space that is just really democratizing Wi-Fi access across the country, partly through solar power, which is incredible. And they're built Wi-Fi hotspots for anyone to access on the moving vehicles that you see everywhere in the cities of East Africa, which are called matatus. That's the Swahili name for it. And I kind of give all these examples of technological entrepreneurship, people building 3D printers, design fabs, all of this. And so a lot of this is able to happen partly because there's an internet access point, like a cable, fiber optic cable landing in Mombasa, which is in East Africa. And it's really interesting. It's the infrastructure is supports people doing this kind of innovative entrepreneurship. And the infrastructures of having connectivity can mean a lot when they're combined with human creativity and entrepreneurship. And, you know, Africa is the site of so much innovation. You know, for example, one of the most classic cases, which I bet you know about, is M-Pesa, which is like a mobile money kind of approach. And that basically is people were not provided with banking services. They were too poor. You know, it was seen as not secure. And instead of just sort of, again, being kind of upset about it or just, you know, stuck with no other opportunities, they literally built and innovated with the mobile telecom company a way to exchange mobile phone credits just peer-to-peer. And so that has allowed people to engage in all forms of decentralized and even, you know, in a sense, free market exchanges, not just in Kenya, but actually all over Africa. Even a country like Somalia, which has been plagued by a lot of issues with civil wars and so on, is almost completely a cashless society. It's almost all digital currencies. People just, digital currency, not cryptocurrency, but people actually just trading credits on their phones. So these are workarounds people find where they face constraints and they're able to innovate in light of that. So The book, you know, Beyond the Valley is telling these stories from all over the world. It's looking also at examples like this that are here in the United States, even in Europe. And it's also, and I do want to mention this, it's also featuring interviews that I did with some very leading well-known political economic figures from the business world, from the political world. You know, I interviewed people like Elizabeth Warren and David Axelrod, you know, Obama's data guy. I interviewed Lawrence Lessig, who's a very well-known scholar, a legal scholar of the internet and free software. I talked to many, many different people, a number of labor leaders, etc. So I tried to, on the one hand, kind of get call together the opinions and thoughts and experiences of people who are very influential in shaping what technology means and looks like in our country and to some extent around the world. But I also tried to tell stories of bottom-up innovation. So I, in a sense, that what I want us to do at this moment where everyone's kind of worried, in a sense, there's bipartisan concern around big technology in this country, which is kind of incredible. Republicans and Democrats and progressives and all types want to do something about this. And what I want to say is it's not just a crisis moment. There's all sorts of opportunities if we open up our thinking beyond the valley, both metaphorically and literally.
That's interesting. And you spoke, as you mentioned, to a number of people, especially some prominent people on the left who are within politics, who are crafting visions for what a post-Trump administration world might look like after the election in just about a year. People, as you mentioned, like Elizabeth Warren, David Axelrod, Eric Holder, Noam Chomsky. Yeah. And I'm curious what you've learned. You diagnose some of this in the book in terms of the implications of politics and what the different scenarios might be depending upon who's elected in the next presidential election cycle. Anyway, what's your own analysis of this?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, as I was alluding to, is that right now there's bipartisan concern around big tech for somewhat different reasons. You might have noticed that President Trump, for example, tweeted out something about 6 weeks or so ago, saying, hey, there's the study that was done that basically shows that Google and Google's bias, Google search results contributed to me. To several million votes being taken away from me in 2016, and even more votes being taken away from the Republican Party in 2018. So there's those sorts of concerns that there might be liberal bias influencing algorithmic systems. So there's those concerns. I did talk to mainly progressives and liberals and so on. And, full disclosure, I myself identify in that camp. But I am interested in these issues and beyond the valley. More generally for all of us as Americans and more generally as human beings across our differences. I don't want our political differences to divide us from being a common people. That's the key point. But there are a range of different opinions and perspectives on what's going on here. I think more or less a lot of people are interested in, so obviously Elizabeth Warren has come out and said, let's break up big tech. It's a bit of a brand slogan. But she has made some points that, that she believes, companies like Amazon, Facebook, and even Google operate as monopolies or monopolies in the making because they're horizontally integrative. So take, for example, Amazon. Amazon is dominant in the e-commerce space, right? I mean, they're just incredible. Remember when they used to sell books, Peter? So now it's, dominant in that space, but they also control Amazon Web Services to a significant extent, which means cloud-based computing systems. They're extending into other domains as well, as we know, facial recognition, Whole Foods, even the Washington Post is owned by Mr. Bezos. So her point, Warren's point to me is, if you have a leg up in one area, you shouldn't be able to use that to have a leg up in every other area, right? That's sort of a market dominant strategy. So she makes similar kind of statements about, WhatsApp, Instagram, both owned by Facebook, and then Facebook as a social media platform itself. So there's the regulatory aspects of things. What I'm, I myself don't push hard on those themes. I think we should put all hands on deck. What I'm getting at with Beyond the Valley is let's just make sure that everything is balanced, right? That, workers have opportunities to access jobs in the future, that the economic inequalities that we see in the United States and actually even more dramatically across the world don't end up being amplified by technological innovations that are only defined within the valley rather than beyond the valley, right? These concerns around the gig economy and automation, even AI systems having all sorts of, significant bias issues. We got to make sure we get these things right. Those are win-wins for both people in the valley as well as outside of the valley. Folks at Facebook and Google, they don't want to build technologies that turn out to be, racist or homophobic or xenophobic. That's not their intention, but they're building systems that are turning out to have some of those outcomes because the voices beyond the valley aren't part of the design process, aren't part of the auditing process. So what I want to get at, and I'm pushing for this, and I'll be publishing an op-ed piece with a major newspaper probably in the next few weeks, Peter, about this, is what I call a digital bill of rights, which is to say, hey, here are ways in which tech companies and the rest of us can work together. Here's ways in which they can say, hey, with all the jobs that we're likely to take away through automated technologies, that's fine, but here's the ways we're going to take care of you through those transitions. Here might be jobs of the future. Here are ways in which we're going to, disclose to you, in at least on a heuristic level or a qualitative level, here's the data we have about you. Here is, maybe we're going to, in good faith, tell you, like, this is why you see what you see when you log on to Facebook, or why you see what you see when you do a Google search result. Maybe we can do something about, data brokers, which are third parties, quite wealthy companies, where I could purchase your credit card records, Peter. Is that something that we want as a society? Maybe we can regulate that to some extent. More than anything, it's, for me, I have a you know, even though I'm critical again, I have an optimism because I've come out of this tech world. And I know a lot of folks that are very high up in these companies are friends of mine, you know, I went to college with. And I know that in many cases, they think they're engineering for society without realizing that mistakenly, in many cases, they're engaging, it's a bit of a loaded term, but they're engaging in social engineering. And that's in many cases unintentional again. So again, my point is, let's put all hands on deck, all the cards on the table. Let's think about it as a design palette, as a great, you know, engineering and humanist challenge, a challenge for us as human beings to think about what kind of world do we want? How do we ensure it provides these companies with appropriate return for the efficient and excellent services they've provided, but it shouldn't come at a zero-sum cost for the rest of us, you know? So if you almost think about it on a game theoretic level, you don't want, you know, you don't want one person to stay on the boat and everybody else to be thrown off the boat, you know? You want everybody to gain. We want an internet that lifts all of us because that's good for companies too, you know? That's good for people who are your listeners and people who are Forbes supporters, right? Because they don't want to be creating businesses or in the business sector in a world where, you know, almost no one but them is worth anything economically, just sort of as a philosophical thought experiment. So I see us at arriving at a very interesting inflection point, Peter, when it comes to the internet. We have an opportunity to get this right. It's going to require transparency and collaboration, maybe at times some forms of regulation, but let's just be smart about it. Let's apply, let's think about this in a win-win productive way. That's what I'm pushing for in this book and in the Digital Bill of Rights piece. And I've written a couple op-eds summarizing some of this as well. I had a piece in the LA Times last week. I have a piece coming out next week in Wired. We also have a piece coming out in the Financial Times on blockchain and cryptocurrencies in about 2 weeks. So I'm trying to put this out also in short pieces as well.
Wonderful. We'll keep our eyes out for those that are yet to come. Well, Ramesh, thank you so much for your time today. Again, the book is Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of the wisdom from the book, your vast experiences. It's been a great conversation.
I love it. And I hope to continue joining you. And I hope to see you soon in person, too. Thank you, Peter, for having me.
Likewise, yeah. Ramesh. I'll look forward to it.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Pradeep Khosla, the Chancellor of the University of California, San Diego.